Are we in a trade war?
Well, it's certainly a skirmish.
I would say tensions are very high. I don't know what to consider. There's a lot of rhetoric around trade wars.
If these trade negotiations become a trade war, then we have a problem.
President Trump says Americans are losing in trade deals, that we're getting a raw deal.
What's happened to you is very, very unfair. It's another typical one-sided deal against the United States.
We have trade deficits with almost every country.
It's a travesty.
It's a disgrace.
It's a horrible trade deal.
Disaster for our country.
So he's imposing and threatening tariffs on some of our biggest trading partners, our allies like Mexico, Canada, and the EU, and some of our biggest competitors like China, announcing most recently a 25% tariff on $50 billion of Chinese products.
President Xi, he's a great man. He's a wonderful guy, but at some point we have to straighten it out. We lost $500 billion in trade deficits last year. We can't do that.
China immediately responded, promising equal retaliation. China's Ministry of Commerce issued a statement calling, quote, on all countries to take joint action, resolutely put an end to this outdated and regressive behavior, and firmly defend the common interests of mankind. Likewise, the EU, Canada, and Mexico are also threatening to impose tariffs on U.S. stuff like orange juice, pork, Harleys, and bourbon. The industries threatened by retaliatory tariffs, well, a lot of them are in Trump country, and that isn't by accident. For one Iowa farmer, that's concerning.
There's been tremendous dollars lost in the pork industry already since steel tariffs were imposed on China. When we look at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, that is the daily market for hogs, those prices dropped dramatically after the tariffs were announced. We're feeling the effect right now.
I'm Amy Walter, and today on The Takeaway, will Republicans, voters and politicians alike, who stayed loyal to the president at nearly every turn, continue to stand with him when these tariffs begin to bite?
I'm not in favor of the administration's goal.
As a voter, it's one part of the issues area that I will consider as I go to the ballot box.
He campaigned on an America First agenda. He won on that agenda, and he's carrying it out.
It's been a wild week in American diplomacy. After a contentious weekend at the G7 summit in Canada, the administration got into a war of words with some of our closest allies.
We're like the piggy bank that everybody's robbing, and that ends.
We're polite, we're reasonable, but we also will not be pushed around.
There's a special place in hell for any foreign leader that engages in bad faith diplomacy with President Donald J. Trump.
I think Americans understand it's simply not the case. That action is also illegal under WTO and NAFTA rules.
Days later, we witnessed a historic handshake between the President of the United States and North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. The leaders signed a deal to, quote, build a lasting and stable peace regime on the Korean Peninsula and to, quote, work toward the goal of denuclearization.
We are starting from a very high plane. We're starting from a very good relationship. This has been a very big day in terms of the world. I think it's been a lot of people are saying it's historic.
We're all calling it historic.
Yeah, even my enemies are calling it historic.
Susan Glasser is here with me. She's a staff writer at The New Yorker and author of the weekly letter from Trump's Washington. And Alex Lawson, Law 360's senior reporter on international trade and the co-host of Law 360's Pro Se podcast. Thank you both for joining me. Susan, I want to start with you. We've had a busy week in U.S. diplomacy, and I want to get your observations about what we saw from the president on the world stage, both at the G7 and in North Korea.
Well, thank you so much, Amy. I have to say, it's one of those extraordinary weeks where you feel like everything that we've been talking about and thinking was going to happen for the last year and a half, it feels like with President Trump, it's now started to happen. He has a radically different vision of America in the world and his own role in it. And he started to play that out. He is a guy who was comfortable with one-on-one diplomacy, this personalized form of almost, you know, l'état c'est moi, right? You know, it's the president negotiating mano a mano with world leaders. Never mind the details so much. It's more the optics of it that he seems to prefer. And then this amazing thing where he really truly seems to be more comfortable with adversaries, with the world's tough guys, than with America's allies, with whom he has a serious bone to pick. He somehow believes that places like Canada and Germany have ripped America off, while he's perfectly comfortable engaging in even chummy negotiations with countries like China and North Korea. So it's an amazing turnabout in world affairs like I never expected to see.
Although we do see in the polling most recently, Susan, that an overwhelming majority of Americans say, yeah, we think this is a good idea that the president is sitting down with Kim Jong-un. So how do you think that plays out over the course of these next few months in terms of giving the president at least some popular backing for what he's doing?
Well, look, that's why he's doing it, Amy. You know, that everyday Americans are understandably not focused on the details of arms control and nuclear negotiations with North Korea. That's not their job. That's the president's job. And in that, there's an incredible gap between those who actually follow this issue substantively, who believe that President Trump came away with one of the weakest agreements of any American president ever. Remember that while he had this face-to-face meeting with Kim that Kim wanted, other presidents have actually already reached various deals with North Korea to end its nuclear program, deals that were on paper at least stronger than the one that came out of the summit this week. And of course, North Korea broke those agreements. Now, the devil will be in the follow-on details in terms of the substance, but Donald Trump is not a substance man. He's all flash. He's all sizzle. And, you know, look, of course Americans are in favor of peace. Talking is better than shooting.
Alex, let's talk about your take on this. You know, we've seen a lot of heated rhetoric,
Certainly
at the G7 about trade. But is this war of words going to turn into something more substantive than just words?
It definitely could. And I think the thing you're seeing on like a grander stage is that for decades, basically since World War II, trade policy functioned as sort of an extension of foreign policy, right? We the United States, have identified a handful of governments, nations that we should be on sound geopolitical footing with, you know, to secure our place in the world. And our economic policies flow from that. It's like, well, we should be on good commercial terms with them too. Now what you're seeing is quite the opposite. It's almost the inverse, because the president campaigned on a very tough trade message. It was the center of his economic messaging on the campaign trail. And now, because they followed through in making all these aggressive enforcement moves, it is sort of dictating our geopolitical relationships with these countries. And that's what you saw bubbling over at the G7, as Susan was mentioning. As for what could come, I mean, it's definitely escalating into more of a war of words, because we're moving forward with tariffs, actual concrete tariffs on many different fronts, on many different products, and they're beginning to take root. And that will have real both economic and political ramifications in the very near future.
Do you think, Alex, it's official we are in a trade war?
This is sort of like my little hobby horse. It's more of a semantic thing. I don't know. I said this last time I was on the show. I don't really like that term just because it's kind of scary sounding and it is without a firm meaning, because war in the context has a very specific meaning. But that's a semantic issue. It's definitely probably the most serious sort of escalation of trade barriers, certainly since I think the 1930s sort of Smoot-Hawley tariff bill, which plunged us deeper into the Great Depression. I don't know if that'll happen again. The economy's a lot more stable now, but we're definitely veering into like sort of uncharted waters here.
And Susan, I want to raise this issue that you brought up at the very beginning, sort of this reimagining or rejiggering of alliances. The argument from the president and from others who support him is, look, our allies are always going to be our allies. This isn't changing all that much. And quite frankly, the rest of the world needs us a lot. They're not going to abandon us. They're not suddenly going to walk away from the table and you know, align themselves with China or other parts of the world. They need us more than we need them. What do you say to that?
Well, look, I think you're right that that is clearly a part of the calculus that has informed many of Trump's most provocative and controversial decisions with the European allies, with Mexico and Canada. For example, blowing up the Iran nuclear deal, which he did just a few short weeks ago. It seems like forever already. But I think Donald Trump is about to find the limits of his bullying. The political imperatives in many of these countries are very different than the political imperatives here inside the United States that are causing Republicans on Capitol Hill, for example, to roll over and acquiesce before Donald Trump's policies. Republicans are doing that because their own primary electorate has remained very supportive of Trump. So they have a political incentive to fall in line with the president, even when he's forcing them to swallow policies like anti-free trade policies that are absolutely antithetical to what they believe. Same thing on Russia. Same thing on many of these other issues. But for other world leaders, that is not the case. And I think Trump may not have calculated on that. You look at his fight with Justin Trudeau in Canada, for example, and I think Trump really misread the situation. He didn't realize he's wildly unpopular in Canada. He's wildly unpopular in France, in Germany, and elsewhere in other countries where our allies are actually facing a moment of truth with their own publics, where their own publics would cheer them on if they start to oppose President Trump more vociferously than they have up until now. But your basic point is absolutely right. What I hear as I travel around from our European allies, from our Canadian allies, is a sense of anguish. Why is the United States and its president seeking to blow up the rules-based international liberal order that was constructed by the United States for its own benefit, and which the United States has led for seven decades? They don't understand why the United States is walking away from the alliance that it itself leads.
Well, that leads me into a more existential question for the two of you, which is, it seems that what we're seeing in this country is what we're seeing around the globe, an economic system that has had winners and losers. And we know that the president and many other political leaders around the country, populist leaders, are offering something to the losers, right?
Yeah.
Here's why you haven't won, and we're going to put these protectionist policies in place to help you.
Yeah.
But the people who are on the winning side, the people who defend free trade, don't seem to have much to give to the losers. So is that part of the problem? Do the people who are on the winning side need to admit or acknowledge that there are losers and then also give them something? And if they could, what would it be, Alex?
Well, I speak purely just from a trade perspective. That's sort of my area. I leave the geopolitics to Susan. But I mean, I think kind of the misconception in that regard is sort of that, and it's been taken to the nth degree under Trump, is that, you know, he comes from a business background and he is of the opinion that like every deal you make must have a winner and a loser, and trade kind of always does. But the whole idea of talking with your allies and trying to sort of lower trade barriers as best you can is the idea of creating something that works well enough for everyone. Now, as you say, there will always be like we never have 100% unemployment and things like that. And so there will always be pockets of sort of strife, but it's always been about reaching an equilibrium with sort of your like-minded partners. And that seems to be almost completely out the window now, because the administration sort of came in and identified a number of metrics that they didn't like over the last several decades of trade policy and said, we're going to fix those. Chief among those is the trade deficit. I don't know if you want me to get too
wonky. No, but I would, because I mean, that is Trump's argument, right?
Yeah.
The president's argument from the very beginning as a candidate was, this trade deficit is our biggest economic problem. And once we fix that,
right,
the economy is going to do better. So is that the case?
There is economic literature to make both sides of that argument, but a pretty strong consensus has emerged that the trade deficit is not the best metric for ascertaining economic health. And the reason that you most often hear is the grocery store analogy. You're familiar with this?
Mm-mm.
The idea is, okay, let's say you spend $100 a month on groceries, just to have round numbers. At the end of the year, you would look and say, I have a $1,200 deficit with my grocery store. I gave them $1,200 and I have no money. What gives? Of course, the answer is you got food. Like, when you look at the trade deficit, it's not like a spreadsheet about how much money you have or do not have anymore. It is private citizens and often private companies. Government procurement is in there too, but, you know, it's by and large private entities making deals that they deem proper with their own money. The other reason is that the United States, the median income, I believe, is about $40,000. We have a lot of purchasing power. We buy a lot of things. And so it's a little more complicated than just looking at, oh, we have a $300 billion trade deficit with China. This is lousy. The other thing, of course, is that they always say that, you know, more imports means we're not making stuff here, and so no jobs. also kind of paints an incomplete picture. Of course, there are companies that made things here and provide jobs, but about 60% of U.S. imports last year were intermediary goods. Those are goods like components that we brought in here, and companies here use them to make other things. It's an era of global supply chains, interconnected economies. That's kind of what the whole thing, that's what, like what the modern economic order is premised upon. And, you know, in this way, the administration is kind of looking backwards.
Susan, Alex makes great points, excellent economic theory. You, someone who's covered campaigns for a long time, know that what works is what's emotional, and people losing their jobs is really emotional. So thinking about this politically, how do you think the issue of trade tariffs are going to play in 2018, especially in some of these Rust Belt states? I'm thinking in particular of Senator Sherrod Brown, a Democrat who has campaigned as an sort of an anti-free trader for a long time. Does this sort of change the calculus?
Well, it's interesting that you raise that, Amy, because actually what I've picked up is really a lot of concern from Republicans that this is the one area where Donald Trump might be really risking both the strong economy, which is their major case to voters. Believe me, you know, they're not campaigning on what a great guy Donald Trump is. you know, they're campaigning on the fact that it's a strong economy, that Trump is delivering to the conservative agenda, depending on the district that they're in. So many of the red state members of Congress, the red state senators, are actually quite concerned that tariffs and trade war could start to hit them where it hurts. And if you notice, many of the countries targeted by tariffs are carefully tailoring their responses to hit things like Kentucky bourbon and agricultural products in places where there are big core of Trump supporters. And so, you know, it goes both ways. Alex's point, I think, is absolutely right, which is that Donald Trump doesn't seem to really understand how the economy works in the modern world. And the idea of treating everything as a zero-sum interaction, the idea of treating the world as a series of bilateral relationships, right? Like Donald Trump doesn't want to have multi-party alliances,
right,
complicated partnerships, right? He sees everything as like you and me, man to man. That's why he loves these summits with Kim Jong-un. He wants to have that summit with Vladimir Putin, same thing. But that's not how the world works. And again, I think these members of Congress who face re-election in November, you know, their districts are part of the global economy. And that is a real risk factor that they're perceiving. To your point, I think it's much more the point about rhetoric, right? Donald Trump and other populists in Europe, for example, have skillfully played on the anger and resentment and concern and dislocation of, we should point out, a minority of the population here in the United States, a minority of the population in these other countries. And yet it's a very vocal minority. You know, so to me, it's not so much the proactive policies that Donald Trump was offering them, you know, to the extent he offered policies to coal workers, to steel workers in 2016, he's not going to deliver on those. Donald Trump is not going to bring back coal mining as an industry in the United States, right? So it's much more about the feeling that he's generating with his campaign rhetoric. Right?
I would add only, and Susan is absolutely correct in talking about the retaliation. U.S. ag products are always at the top of retaliatory tariffs lists because we sell a bunch of it. And those are almost always, you know, very, very deep red states. Will it be enough to sort of sway their voting preference when either the midterms or the next presidential election comes around? That remains to be seen. The other point, though, Susan rightly identified that the administration has, like, basically since it took power, been touting these bilateral deals. It scrapped TPP on his third day in office. That was a 12-nation Pacific trade agreement. And they want to do bilateral deals with countries, you know, that are like-minded and things like that. But what you've seen over the last, you know, month or so, who would ever want to negotiate with these people? You know, I mean, they're sort of, we're holding summits with like longtime allies and just like throwing them completely under the bus. NAFTA is now a complete circus. They're making these sort of like very unorthodox proposals that have rubbed our strongest trading partners the wrong way. So, I mean, if they're looking to sort of strike out on their own and create this patchwork of like robust trade deals, it's certainly an interesting strategy.
Susan, Alex, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks.
Thank you.
That's Alex Lawson, Law 360's senior reporter on international trade and the co-host of Law 360's Pro Se podcast. And Susan Glasser, she's a staff writer at The New Yorker and author of the weekly letter from Trump's Washington.
Well, I am somewhat anxious about it. I don't mind telling you that.
That's Republican Congressman Kevin Cramer. He's North Dakota's sole member of the House in a state President Trump won by 36 points in 2016. Like other Republican strongholds, North Dakota and its agricultural sector are being targeted by China, Canada, Mexico, and the EU in response to the president's tariffs on foreign steel and aluminum. Cramer is running for Democrat Heidi Heitkamp's Senate seat this November in what will be one of the most competitive races in the country. But even in this very Trump-friendly state, the issue of trade and tariffs are tricky for this Republican congressman.
First of all, I fully support the president's goals in all of these trade issues, whether it's correcting the discrimination against North Dakota and American wheat that's delivered to Canada, or the tariffs on American dairy. It all swirls around as somewhat separate issues that all swirl around the top issue of trade. And I'm a free trader. I come from a state that depends heavily on trade because we grow a lot of food and we produce a lot of energy and we produce a lot of other products and we prefer to sell them into markets. But at the same time, we know that we need to correct a few things. The president intercepted a can at the end of the road in many cases. He campaigned on an America First agenda. He won on that agenda and he's carrying it out.
But are you worried that North Dakota is going to take the brunt of this, that in the end, the farmers in your state, other producers in your state end up having to take a bigger share of the weight than other parts of the country?
Yeah, I think it's a great point, Amy, because I think it's pretty obvious that retaliation is aimed at, you know, certain industries. That's probably strategic. I think it's unfair. I think it's, it's inappropriate. But that said, that's the reality we're dealing with. I just was in a meeting with Secretary Ross, and he's reassuring us that once again, through Secretary Perdue at the Ag Department, he is to provide, as per the president's order, a safety net for farmers should they be hurt in the short run while we play the long game, if you will, to try and win back some of these unfair trade practices that other countries are engaged in. And, you know, I say I'd rather have trade. Our farmers would rather sell products than have the assistance. But at the same time, we want the American farmer treated fairly.
What are farmers in your state telling you? Are they equally anxious? And are they telling you, hey, Congressman, you've got to push back on this tariff stuff. You got to go to Trump and you got to tell him this because this isn't what I voted for. I mean, I like Trump, but I don't like these tariffs. What are they saying to you?
You sound like a lot of North Dakota farmers, Amy. actually, you know, to your point, they do like Trump and they did vote for him and they love the fact that he's rolling back dozens of regulations for every one new one. They love that he's giving them control over their own land. And he also loves the fact that he's trying to correct the wrongs in much of this trade policy. So there's a lot of people that are cheering him on. But at the same time, there is some of this other anxiety, particularly in the soybean world and whatnot. I keep saying, let's everybody calm down, because as we calm down, you know, the markets calm down. And as we express confidence, the markets reflect that confidence. But if we reflect chaos and confusion, then the markets will reflect that.
One of your colleagues, Senator Corker, is also worried about the ability of the executive, and of course, in this case, the executive's President Trump, to be using terms like national security to make trade pacts without the input of Congress. How concerned are you that at the end of the day, you, meaning as a member of Congress, may not get much of a voice in what this looks like?
I would say this. I think that right now, while we're in the middle of a negotiation, I think if we want this to end quickly, what we ought to be doing is standing with our president and help him, you know, win the day and win the concessions and conclude them. And I think by imposing our own political agendas, if you will, at the same time as the president's trying to negotiate, sort of undermines that effort. I think we're better off as a united front, and we could bring a quick end to all of this. But I do have sympathy for Senator Corker's position, and we need to do something as a Congress to restore our Article 1 powers, which is, you know, which has been greatly diminished, not just recently, but over the decades, and not just by Democrats, but by Republicans as well. And I think it's a reasonable discussion to have. I just don't think in the middle of this skirmish is the right time to have it.
Are you convinced that there is something that is done with NAFTA before the fall, and that Congress actually votes on NAFTA?
Sure. It's a great point, Amy, because I think there are two things. One is the renegotiation of NAFTA. The second is if we fail to renegotiate it in a timeline that allows the current Congress to vote on, you know, up or down on it, and I think we're fast approaching that timeline, you know, then what does the president do? And I think, you know, threats to withdraw are problematic. I think that a commitment to continue negotiating a better deal helps bring some calm, the calm that I was talking about earlier. So I think some of it depends on what is the president's next move. I'd prefer to get something
done quickly. Do you think that he would?
I don't know.
Do you have concerns that he would actually pull out unilaterally?
Well, he's proven pretty definitively that he's willing to do what he says he's going to do, and that's what makes his negotiating leverage so powerful. He's demonstrated he'll do what he says he's going to do, and but I've also noticed that he becomes pretty flexible as you get closer to the deal, and that while he says I won't do anything more than this or less than that, you know, when people are negotiating in good faith, he likes to make the deal, and so I have great confidence in his ability to negotiate an appropriate deal. I certainly hope we don't withdraw from NAFTA. It's interesting to note that not a single member of North Dakota's congressional delegation at the time voted for NAFTA. Now we're all anxious about, you know, NAFTA going away. So I think you have to take him at his word. You certainly shouldn't conclude that these are empty threats, because empty threats don't mean much. But at the same time, I think you have to also understand that even when you watch him, whether it's negotiating with Congress on what the corporate income tax rate ought to be, or you know what the four pillars of immigration reform ought to be, you find that at the end of the day, he tends to meet you, maybe not in the middle, maybe more to his side than the middle, but he does eventually close the deal.
That's Republican Congressman Kevin Cramer from North Dakota. This fall, he'll be facing Heidi Heitkamp, who, as a Democrat in this deep red state, has been careful to keep a good relationship with President Trump, but she's been actively campaigning against Trump's trade policies.
Congress needs to decide at what point do they intervene. The administration has a lot of leeway right now on trade because of how trade is organized. I think we need to be sending some signals that there are guardrails, that the administration cannot drive us off the guardrail and into the ravine.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Amy Walter. So where's the congressional oversight in all of this? Tariffs like the ones imposed against Canada, Mexico, and the EU on steel and aluminum were done under what's known as Section 232. Now, this section of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962 gives the president broad power to impose tariffs without having to consult Congress. He can do that on the basis of national security concerns, but some say that's a misuse of this provision.
Tariffs on steel from Canada and Mexico and the EU are not about national security. It's about economic policy.
That's Senator Pat Toomey, a Republican from Pennsylvania. He's not quite ready to call this a trade war, but he says we're getting close.
Well, it's certainly a skirmish. I don't know if it's a full-blown war. I sure hope it doesn't get to that. But there are some small battles that have broken out.
So you have signed on to legislation that was, I think, originally penned by Senator Corker that requires Congress to sign off on tariffs imposed in the name of national security, as these
Correct.
Tariffs on aluminum and steel on Canada were deemed to be. To me, this seems like, I don't know, a pretty basic flexing of congressional oversight, and yet the bill, the amendment, is not going to come up for a vote. Why do you think that is?
The reason is, I think, mostly technical, actually. There are procedural obstacles that the Senate has to deal with, specifically when we attempt to legislate on a matter involving federal revenue and tariffs, of course, directly affect federal revenue. The Constitution requires that revenue bills begin in the House.
So when Senator Corker characterizes this as, well, people don't want to sign on to this or bring this to the floor because they're worried about poking the bear, upsetting the president, do you think that's accurate?
Oh, I think there's definitely some of that as well. Look, there's a debate going on among Republican senators over the extent to which we should oppose President Trump, even if there is broad opposition among Republican senators to some of these trade policies. Look, Republican senators are overwhelmingly, maybe unanimously, pro-trade, pro-NAFTA, deeply concerned about these Section 232 tariffs. So, you know, if it were just talk, if it were just speculation, if it was just rhetoric, then, you know, I would understand. But as of, you know, a couple of weeks ago, the president's actually imposing these tariffs, big tariffs on steel and aluminum, on Canada and Mexico, the European Union, and that's doing real damage. And so I think we have an obligation to stand up and say so and say, look, we can be respectful, but we can respectfully disagree.
What I hear from the Republicans who are free traders, who say, yes, we're anxious about this idea of tariffs, but can't we just let the president, you know, negotiate, give him some running room? If things really go off track, then we start to rein him in. Let's just use the power of our persuasive arguments rather than the law.
So I was trying that approach for quite some time now, but start to look at the accumulation of the record here. First, we had a sugar deal with Mexico, which was a terrible deal, very protectionist, forces Americans to pay consumers to pay about twice the global cost of sugar. But okay, that's a narrow category, one single commodity with a single country. But then we got these tariffs on washer machines and solar panels. There was, in my mind, not a good rationale for that, but okay, a very narrow sector of manufacturing. Then we had the announcement about the Section 232 tariffs, but initially, most countries were excluded, right? So there was an exclusion for Canada and Mexico and the EU. And now the exclusions have gone away. So I think at some point, we've got to say, no, we're going down the wrong road, and we're already getting pretty far down the road. Here's the other thing that I think is important, Amy. If the purpose of these tariffs were to negotiate for freer trade among these nations, then I think that would be an interesting debate. And I might be uncomfortable, but the goal of freer trade would be a worthwhile goal, and we should consider what tactics would help to get us there. My concern is that the president wants to use these tariffs not for freer trade, but actually, to get concessions on changes to NAFTA, for instance, that I think are counterproductive. So I'm not in favor of the administration's goal.
Okay, listeners, let me give you some context on what's going on here. The tariffs on steel and aluminum imposed in the name of national security were meant to help American steelmakers compete. U.S. Steel, which is based in Pittsburgh, announced it would reopen an Illinois blast furnace, bringing back some 800 jobs. And that's the whole point, right? To help the American worker. But Senator Toomey says it's not that simple.
Almost 40% of all Pennsylvania exports go to either Canada or Mexico. And since NAFTA was signed into law, exports to Mexico are up 500%. These are huge and hugely important markets for us. Now, people are aware, and obviously the loss of jobs in manufacturing, which has occurred in recent decades, is very, very painful for people who lose those jobs. But let's be honest, the main driver for those lost jobs is automation.
How do you think people in your state, how will they be impacted if indeed we get to this place where we are having, we can call it a skirmish, a trade war, we're doing a tit-for-tat retaliatory tariffs? How are people right now who are listening in Pennsylvania? They may not believe that, well, this doesn't really impact me. That seems like this seems really esoteric.
Well, it seems that way, but it wouldn't be that way if you work for a chemical company in Pennsylvania that manufactures chemicals and sells a very large percentage of their output to Mexico. If we get into a trade war and Mexico decides to impose big tariffs on those chemicals, then European competitors will be able to take away that market share and Pennsylvanians will lose their jobs. people would see it differently. In the dairy sector, for instance, where cheese products that are made from Pennsylvania dairy are sold to Mexico in very substantial quantities. Again, the Mexicans can replace that with European cheeses, and our dairy farmers can shut down and just lose their farms. So if it, God forbid, it does escalate and we get into a downward spiral and a full-blown trade war, then what Pennsylvanians will see is higher costs for products that we buy from Mexico that we'll have to source somewhere else or pay this big tariff on, which, now let's keep in mind, right, when the president imposes tariffs on products from Canada and Mexico, that's a tax that American consumers have to pay. So that added cost will show up in the consumer goods that they buy directly, or higher priced goods from some other country, and we'll lose the jobs that are associated with our exports to these countries.
What about in places, you know, the Bethlehem's part of your state where the hope is, and in Pittsburgh, that maybe these are places where manufacturing, steel manufacturing, aluminum manufacturing can come back, right? This idea that if we do this, we are doing this tariffs to help the manufacturing here at home of these metals.
Well, I think everybody understands that Bethlehem Steel is not going to be making steel in Bethlehem. That's never coming back. Now, U.S. Steel is still a vibrant company that makes steel very successfully in Pittsburgh, and I sure hope that their business can thrive. If you impose tariffs, then you know we've seen an increase in the cost of steel, and so no question about it, there's a handful of steel makers who will benefit from that. The problem is there are many multiples of companies and employees in the downstream companies, the companies that use steel. Take Allegheny Technologies, for instance. They import steel slabs that aren't made domestically, and they use them to make products that they sell very successfully in the United States. You put a 25% tariff on that product, and they are not competitive, and they might have to close plants. And I have a list of over 20 companies that have approached me and said they desperately need an exclusion because these tariffs will be devastating to their business. So, you know, one of the realities of imposing these taxes on American consumers is you end up picking winners and losers. Yeah, sure. If your company is protected from foreign competition this way, that's probably good for your business. But if you're on the consuming end, then it can be very, very problematic.
Senator Pat Toomey, the Republican from Pennsylvania. Whether this is a trade war, a skirmish, or just a bump in the road, it got me wondering, is there historical precedent for a moment like this? It turns out, there is. The year is 1928. Herbert Hoover was running for president.
I cannot too strongly urge every voter to go to the polls on election day and cast his ballot in the way that his judgment and his own conscience shall dictate. Whatever the common judgment of the whole of a great people may be, that judgment will be right.
The economy in the early 20s had been strong, but as efficiency grew in agriculture, the nation's farmers began to feel the pinch.
There was, it is true, a significant agricultural depression. This is still when 50% of Americans lived in rural areas, and the efficiencies to agriculture had become so great by that point that it was difficult to continue to make a living as a farmer with half the population doing that.
Brian Domitrovic is a senior associate with the Laffer Center and professor of economic history at Sam Houston State University.
Farmers had a tough time selling their products, and they tried to get a tariff against foreign farm imports. Tariffs had been lowered in 1913. They were increased a little bit in 1922. And so they said they wanted a big tariff in 1928. And they instituted a process in Washington to get that going.
Hoover, an Iowa native, was sympathetic to their plight, and he won the election in a landslide, carrying 40 states, including all of the Farm Belt.
Hail,
The agricultural tariff was already in the works by the time Hoover took office, and other industries decided they wanted a slice of the pie, too.
In a very fateful move, a bunch of industrialists jumped on the same train and said, well, if we're going to have an agricultural tariff, we want a big industrial tariff, too, industrial goods tariff. And Congress took something like 10,000 hours of testimony in 1928-1929 from all sorts of interests, mainly manufacturing, actually. And it all culminated in something called the Smoot-Hawley Tariff of June 1930, which Hoover signed. By all the best accounts, that's really the event that more than any other caused the Great Depression of the 1930s.
For the majority, it means the interminable line outside factory gates, desperately hoping for a job that rarely comes. It means hunger and a march of the unemployed in the nation's capital.
A month before the election in 1932, President Hoover found himself back in Iowa in front of thousands. He spoke for over an hour addressing the hard times that the nation was facing in the wake of the Great Depression.
Thousands of our people in their bitter distress and losses today are saying that things could not be worse. No person who has any remote understanding of the forces which confronted this country during the past 18 months ever utters that remark. Had it not been for the immediate and unprecedented actions of our government, things would be infinitely worse today.
And despite its role in the devastation of the nation's economy, a portion of that speech was dedicated to defending the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act.
At the very basis of safety to American agriculture is the protective tariff on farm products. The Republican Party originated and proposes to maintain the protective tariff on agricultural products. We will even widen that further if it is necessary to protect agriculture.
Herbert Hoover lost the election in 1932 to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who won 42 states, including, yes, all of the Farm Belt. So you see, the issue of protecting important American industries and jobs isn't new, and it's always come with trade-offs and consequences. Every president has had to deal with this, even the fictional ones.
Trying to export their way out of their own economic problems.
Yes, sir.
And by dumping low-priced steel on the U.S., you know what they're asking for?
A protectionist response.
They're begging for a protectionist response. Steel and mining employ 170,000 workers. They're not going to sit around while discount steel comes flying into. How you doing? They're going to want retaliatory tariffs. And you know what that means?
A return to Smoot-Hawley and the Great Depression.
A return to Smoot-Hawley and the Great Depression.
Well, you should go to Japan and tell them that, sir. Charlie. Sir.
Leo, I'm walking over to the press and telling them the retaliatory tariffs are going to cost American taxpayers $800,000 for every job saved.
We're not taking questions. Let's get in the car.
Well, there is a West Wing clip for everything. Let's jump ahead a little further in U.S. trade history. You know, when President Trump announced steep tariffs on foreign imports of steel and aluminum, the international community, including some of the United States' closest trading partners, promised swift retaliation. This heated rhetoric has a lot of people nervous. And while this moment certainly feels like uncharted territory, there's actually a pretty recent, fairly similar historical example that might give us clues as to how this could play out. Back in 2002, President George W. Bush issued his own set of tariffs on all steel imports, which angered those within his own party, as well as international trading partners.
The steel industry felt like it was under siege from a lot of imports coming in from around the world, and they began arguing that they needed a bigger solution to take care of the problem. I don't think that the Bush administration, I mean, they were kind of a free trade administration. They weren't necessarily inclined to do it, but they saw a political advantage to doing it. Eventually, they made the decision to launch this investigation, this safeguard investigation, which led to Bush's decision to impose tariffs on steel from around the world, similar to what President Trump has done.
That's Doug Palmer, senior trade reporter with Politico. We talked about how both the Trump and Bush administrations seem to have similar motivations for their tariffs. But while the current president is relying on this argument of trade as national defense, the Bush administration went about his tariffs in a different way.
What the Bush administration did was they did a what's called a safeguard investigation. And under WTO rules and under U.S. law, you can take a safeguard action if there's a surge of imports that threatens to damage the domestic industry. And it basically it allows like a 3 or 4, potentially longer, year period of import protection in order for the industry to restructure. The industry felt like it was under siege from these imports. And he says, okay, I'm going to give you safeguard relief for 3 years. We're going to impose a 25% tariff on something like 14 categories of steel. And then the idea was after 3 years, it was going to go away. But it still was very unpopular around the world. And it was immediately challenged at the WTO by the European Union, Japan, a long list of other countries. And those other countries also moved to start retaliating on the United States, just like they're doing now with Trump.
Looking back at 2002, after the WTO said, this doesn't fly under our rules, the Bush administration ended them after 18 months, the tariffs after 18 months, not for the full 3 years. So is that in reaction to WTO, or were they doing this to avoid retaliation?
Well, it was kind of a combination of both. Once the decision went against them, they decided the best course was to comply rather than live with retaliation imposed by trading partners. They were relatively short-lived.
I do think it's interesting, the point you raised earlier, that when we think about the George W. Bush era as a free trader, I'm curious what it was like internally. Where was the pressure coming from to do this?
Right. Well, I think that it was a political calculus. He had won West Virginia in the 2000 election, and so he felt some obligation to help those workers. And I think that they felt like this would be something they could do to pay them back. I remember going to Ways and Means hearings around that time and you know, hearing from people all arguing what dire straits the steel industry is in and how we need to do something.
And so here we are 16 years later, and we're still hearing about the steel industry being in dire straits. What was the final verdict on these tariffs?
Well, I mean, I think people in the steel industry felt like that they actually did help them restructure. I think they felt like they would have been more successful had they been able to operate for their full 3 years. You know, other people argue that they cost more jobs than they saved, like in downstream industries in particular. So, you know, the final verdict kind of depends on where you are in this debate.
Right.
The steel industry liked it well enough that they're enthusiastically behind what Trump is doing again this time. But, you know, most industries like it when you provide import protection for them.
Given your experience watching the 2002 steel tariff decision, what do you think this tells us about where we might be going with this in 2018?
Well, I think it tells us that other countries will defend their interests and other countries have domestic constituencies. President Trump wants to make good on his campaign promises, and I can certainly understand his impulse to do that. But other leaders don't want to look weak before their people, and so they have to respond. I've covered trade for a long time, and aside from the Bush steel tariffs, I've never really quite covered a situation where everybody is so upset with the U.S. at the same time. I mean, there's always trade disputes, and people are always threatening to impose, you know, tariffs on each other, usually to enforce a WTO decision that the other party doesn't want to implement. And those often get called trade wars, and maybe that's a bit of an exaggeration. And maybe it's even a bit of an exaggeration to call what we're in right now a trade war. But it is, you know, it is at a higher level than I've seen.
Doug Palmer, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome.
Across industries, American workers are bracing for the impact of tariffs.
My name is Wayne Fredericks, and I farm in northern Iowa near Osage. You know, I make a living by raising corn and soybeans, and when these markets go down like that, it really affects my bottom line. And, you know, the tariffs on steel affects the cost of our machinery and equipment that we buy as well. So we're kind of getting hit from both the products we buy and the products we sell.
My name is David Eichert. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for Air Tractor, Inc. It's giving us some concern. It's something we're not real pleased with right at the moment. Our planes, which we build here, have steel tubing and they have aluminum skins. So when you start talking about increasing tariffs, which means increasing prices, increasing our material costs, that impacts us directly.
I'm a fourth generation farmer. My great-grandpa farmed, my grandpa farmed, my dad farmed, and I grew up on a farm, always wanted to farm. When I graduated high school, I started farming with my dad, and so I've been farming a little over 30 years.
That last voice there was Bob Hemesoth. His farm is in a town called Decorah, way up in the far northeast corner of Iowa. Bob is a Republican. He supported Donald Trump in 2016, and he says trade is critical to his business.
Trade is vitally important to my operation and to my family's ability to sustain our way of life. On our farm, we raise hogs as well as corn, and roughly 23% of the pork that is produced in the United States is, or the meat from those hogs, is exported. So that's a tremendous market, and losing any of that market automatically reflects on my family's ability to make a living.
So that's a very good transition into what we're hearing right now from the administration talking about raising tariffs on steel, which other countries, China, maybe our friends to the north and south, Canada and Mexico, saying they're going to retaliate on some agriculture items. What's your reaction to that?
It's very concerning because it will affect our ability to export the pork and the corn and all those agricultural products that they might be considering putting tariffs on. I guess what we're looking at is and what I would tell the administration is that let's get these deals worked out. Let's get our differences worked out. Let's continue to keep these markets open. Let's continue to work on those markets and work on expanding new markets. I know the administration talks about doing trade deals in other areas. I'm all for that. Let's build those markets. Trade is essential to the economy of the United States, from the normal consumer to myself in agriculture. And agriculture is a bright spot for trade.
Bob, were you supportive of the president when he ran for president in 2016? Did you vote for him?
Yes, I did vote for him.
Were you worried about his rhetoric on trade? He talked a lot on the campaign trail about how terrible NAFTA was and that he was going to renegotiate trade deals. So was that in your mind as you cast your vote for him?
Well, you know, there's a lot of things that go into a person's vote. There's a lot mm-hmm. of issues that influence that. What I can tell you is that trade got a bad rap, I would say, in the past in the last presidential election. All sides were condemning trade to a certain level, one way or the other. And to me, that was probably the frustrating part, is that the voter that doesn't necessarily think about trade from a regular standpoint probably didn't consider all the ramifications. For myself in agriculture, yes, it was concerning to me, but I was hearing negative things on trade from all sides. So at the end of the day, I guess as a someone that voted for President Trump, I feel that I have the opportunity to influence his thought process and to continue a dialogue with him and his administration to tell them and to show them how important keeping these markets open are and expanding new markets.
Do you think that he's receptive to that? I know that your two senators are also making that case.
I would say that the president and his administration, as I have sent letters to them and to my legislators, and as I get feedback when I talk to my senators and my legislators, they say that the president is listening. And I know that there's a lot of angles to all these things. I guess my plea to them is that let's get these deals negotiated as quickly as possible. Let's get moving. Let's keep these markets open and continue to build on that.
When will you know if this trade skirmish that we're in right now is impacting you? How will you feel it, and how quickly will you feel that?
We're actually feeling that right now. If you listen to some of the ag economists, there's been tremendous dollars lost in the pork industry already since steel tariffs were imposed on China and the ramifications of that. When we look at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, that is the daily market for hogs, those prices dropped dramatically after the tariffs were announced. They have rebounded some since, but I would say that we're feeling the effect right now.
So what would you like for your representatives in Congress to do to help alleviate this?
my continuing message to my legislators is continue to press the president and his team the importance of these markets, these trade markets, whether it's Canada, Mexico, China, I could name country after country. Continue to press them to get these deals negotiated. Trade deals have to work for everybody involved. NAFTA is a great example that has worked for all three countries. NAFTA is 20 years old. Yes, it did probably need some updating. But the message I send is, let's get this done, let's get it negotiated, and make these deals great for agriculture, great for this country, and move on to opening new markets for all of our products.
Will these tariffs and the potential impact on your farm have an impact on how you think about voting in this upcoming election?
Yes, as a voter that I like to consider myself well-informed, it will be one of the things that I look at from a broad scope of issues and how the candidates stand on them. So it's one part of the process, one piece of the issues area that I will consider as I go to the ballot box.
So that's one Trump voter's opinion. And here's my take. Our modern, interconnected, global economy has created winners and losers. As a candidate, President Trump campaigned on a promise to help make the losers, many of them who once worked in manufacturing jobs that are now gone, winners again. And to do it, he'd get tough on those countries who were responsible for taking those jobs and the way of life that came with them. Economists tell us it's more complicated than this. It's about automation and technology and the normal churn of a healthy economy. But they failed to offer a better answer for how to make the losers winners again. Or if they have one, they aren't doing a very good job of telling them what it is. The reality is, simply defending the status quo isn't good enough, at least when it comes to making the political case. That was my takeaway. What's yours? You can always find us on Facebook and leave us a comment there. And of course, call us with anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send a tweet to @TheTakeaway or to me at Amy E. Walter. Thanks so much for being with us today. I'm Amy Walter, and this is The Takeaway. See you next week.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.